This is the Muscles and Management Podcast, where we build your body and your business. Talking all things training, sports performance, and business for athletes and aspiring coaches to enhance your training and better your career. Muscles and Management is brought to you by Challenger Strength with your host, Jerry DeFilippo.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode number 36 of the Muscles and Management Podcast. As always, before we get started, just want to remind, beg, plead, everyone to look at it. For, you know, if you're a listener and you're enjoying it, throw us a rating or a review. You know, really helpful. And we're at 68 right now, I believe. Would love to get it to 75. Eventual goal is 100. You know, you guys have been great with those so far. So as always, if you're a new listener and you haven't had a chance to yet and you're enjoying the content, definitely do that for me. It'd be great. If you're a new listener as well, subscribe, get updates right to your phone every Wednesday. These go up, I think, 1 a.m. Eastern time. So pretty consistent with that, and you'll get updates on all that kind of stuff. So, definitely do that. I want to shout out the last couple episodes, as I always do. Last week, Max Schmarzo, known as Strong by Science on Instagram and Twitter. Fantastic episode. A lot of great feedback. Honestly, even, you know, for the guy like me doing the podcast, I you know, really took some stuff that we talked about and, you know, have thought about it further. Things like, you know, performance indicators for validating programming, you know, looking at the force velocity curve and how we're kind of considering programming for athletes in that sense and all of that kind of stuff. It was just fantastic. So check that out if you haven't yet. That's almost done. 500 downloads in a week, or less than a week, because tomorrow will be a week. 500 downloads for that already. That's huge. The week before, we had Stefan Jones and Rob Hill, my most downloaded episode ever. It's like at 830 right now, downloads, which is insane. Shout out to you guys. I think I mentioned this last week, but over 15,000 views. And before I blinked, we're at 16,000 now. It's just crazy, the growth. I think search thing, the engine, the host, I'm sorry, of the podcast that I use estimates like 700 listeners an episode now, which is awesome. I couldn't imagine this would have gotten to this point, so thank you. With that said, to end my rambling, super excited to have DJ Edwards and Bill Miller on today's show. Just a lot of things we're going to be discussing that are really going to be helpful to the listeners if you're a coach, athlete, parent, etc. We talk about this in every episode, but it's just such an important thing. It's training today, and over the years, it's been so helpful in building speed and power, velocity-based training. I think it's important to bring up with almost every strength coach that I have on that utilizes it and hear their interpretation of it, their use of it, and things like that. I think that's just huge. You know, so it's going to be in almost every episode that I have with a strength coach, so get used to that. We're talking about velocity-based training. Like I said, Bill, DJ, and I are three guys that have utilized sleds for pushing power and pressing power. My idea for this episode and my idea for pairing DJ and Bill together as guests, and honestly having it after the episode with Max last week, is due to the fact that Max posted a Instagram utilizing sleds for pressing power, something I've been doing for a couple of years, and DJ and Bill, he tagged them in it, are guys that have utilized it as well. Two guys that I've bounced ideas off of, Bill especially, I've gone back and forth with him for like a year and a half now. Just very smart, outside the box thinkers, and the way we all utilize the sled for power is an example of that. So stay tuned for that. That's going to be huge. And I want to open up some of how we do what we do with those for the listeners. Of course, building rotational power. You know, DJ, Bill, you know, I am. We're baseball guys. We train a lot of baseball guys. So that's an important topic that I want to go over. And then we're going to wrap up with a little speed. You know, how to get faster, acceleration, top speed, how you can improve the 60, but at the same time, why the 60 isn't an effective test for baseball. And, you know, some of our suggestions for alternatives or things we can do differently moving forward. And last but not least, I forgot to mention this. I want to make sure I get it in. We're going to be talking about some arm care stuff and some of the misconceptions, you know, with arm care, what you should be doing, what you should be looking for, things like that. So as always, mash that subscribe button, rating, review, comment, you know, any opinions, any thoughts, feedback. I hope you guys are enjoying the videos I've been putting together for the shows. I think they've really helped a lot with the growth and exposure. And I won't give away any names yet because I want to solidify scheduling, but some pretty big guests are coming up. So stay tuned for that. Thank you guys, as always, for listening. Enjoy this episode with DJ and Bill. A lot of knowledge bombs coming at you guys. Until next week, peace. All right, guys. I want to welcome on Bill Miller and DJ Edwards. Thanks so much for coming on, guys. I really appreciate your time.
For sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I've been looking forward to having you guys on for a while. I kind of explained in my intro a little bit about how the idea came to me. Max Schmarzo, Strong by Science, I had him on last week. He put a post up related to pushing power and using prowlers for pressing variations, and it's something I've done for a little bit, and he tagged both of you, so I was like, I would really love to have you guys come on together, and you know, obviously that'd be a big topic of what we talk about, but obviously there's just a lot of different stuff, you know, we're going to get to velocity-based training, sprinting, all that kind of stuff, so thrilled to have you guys on and kind of chop it up and see what we can come up with.
Awesome. Absolutely. That sounds good to me. I think he might be hearing the same stuff. Max is one of my good buddies, actually.
Yeah, he mentioned that.
Might be the same interview.
Yeah, small world. Yeah, no, I mean, listen, I've been connected with you guys for quite a while on Twitter, so I'm glad we were able to make it work. You know, I kind of pumped your tires a little bit on the intro, but just, you know, really happy to have you on. I know we agree on a lot of stuff, and I think that's great because we can kind of just, you know, the three of us go at it and then, you know, give the listeners as much as we can. So before we kind of get into, you know, the meat and potatoes of the training stuff, I wanted to give the listeners a little idea on your backgrounds. First and foremost, just in terms of your own athletic careers, I guess, Bill, you could start this one off first if you want, but give us like an idea of like where you're coming from. And I know you were a baseball guy, like, you know, what was it like, college, high school, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so I was a kid who wasn't extremely athletic growing up, so a lot of the things that I did as a baseball player growing up in attempts to become a professional baseball player, it didn't work out so well. I wound up getting cut from indie ball about five times, but in attempts to become a professional player, I followed a lot of Westside Barbell and Joe DiFranco and Eric Cressy, and that really sparked my interest in strength training. So as a player, I went to a small school called Trinity Christian, and then I tried out for a ton of independent ball teams and signed with a few, but for the most part, it was always just a learning process of trying to figure out that next way to gain as much as I could as a player. And then, and along the way, I learned a lot from just following guys, like I said, Westside Barbell, DeFranco, and guys like that.
Yeah. DJ, you want to kind of take that one?
What was that?
Just in terms of your athletic career, your background, like before you started, sorry, you know, training.
Yeah, sorry, you just broke up. My bad. So kind of the same situation where, you know, I was 5'10", 155, graduating high school. Signed at University of Hawaii and decided to go to the JUCO route, which was the best option for me, obviously. Ended up putting on about 30 to 40 pounds throughout my collegiate career, and ended up having some good success there just through, you know, strength conditioning, finding out what I was missing, and, you know, baseball being an underserved community of strength and conditioning. That's kind of what led me to what I do now.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. I mean, I could honestly say the same thing. You know, my background more so in the, like, what I didn't have, and as I, you know, played baseball growing up and everything, like seeing what you didn't have or like what you needed to get better, and kind of, you know, letting that kind of light the fire to being a coach. In terms of college, and, you know, this is a big topic with me as I was a guy that didn't have a degree in exercise science or kinesiology or anything. What did you guys major in college?
I majored in kinesiology at Trinity Christian, and I got ACE certified right away out of college, and I didn't really pursue much in strength training right away because I was trying to play baseball.
Yeah.
And then after that, after I was done playing ball, then I got CSCS certified. So I've kind of always had that background in it, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. DJ?
Same thing. I was exercise science degree at Metro State University. My wife did.
Damn, I'm the black sheep here, guys. You're making me feel weird.
I mean, school's overrated in my opinion on that side. I mean, I've learned more about coaching, and I was about to say for my wife, I mean, she's a pre-med degree, integrated physiology. She's one of the smartest people I've ever met. Not to pump her horn up or anything, but hopefully she listens to this podcast, which she won't. But I initially started at sports industry operations, switched over to exercise science, and like I said earlier, the biggest thing is finding mentors for me and building my network and learning all that kind of stuff has been the biggest key for me in my athletic and coaching success, I guess.
For sure. Bill, you mentioned Louis Simmons, Westside, DeFranco. I guess we're very similar in that regard. Those are Joe D's huge influence on me, still is to this day. You know, in terms of just like what I modeled a lot of my early philosophies off of. DJ, who would you say, you know, would be your early influences on like your training philosophies as a coach?
You know, I did so much research with, like you said, Joe DeFranco.
Yeah, okay.
Cressy, Lauren Landau, he's in town with me in Colorado. He's a good speed guy. You know, those are kind of my guys I've looked up to. Anybody, you know, wants to teach us, I want to listen, I want to learn.
And, yeah.
You know, I kind of just look at it that way. If somebody puts something out, I'll research about it. Just, you know, learning from them, that's the biggest thing for me. So I can't just narrow down on one person. I'd say
for sure,
you know, hundreds of people, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. So obviously the listeners know where you guys are now, what you're doing, but in terms of like kind of getting your first kind of go at the industry at coaching, you know, what were some of your first jobs, first coaching experiences in the field? DJ, if you want to take that first, then Bill, follow up after him.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I got done with college, I ended up moving to Vail, Colorado, just to be a D-bum up there. And my girlfriend, who's now my wife, was like, what are you going to do with your life? What do you want to do? I was like, well, I've always wanted to train, be a trainer, all this kind of stuff. And so I applied at a bunch of gyms, didn't get job opportunities at all. Didn't get any hits, believe it or not. Ended up taking a job at 24-Hour Fitness for about a year. Did not like it whatsoever. And then I ended up renting a space, about 500 square foot closet, kind of like Joe DeFranco, I feel like.
Yeah.
Renting a space with a squat rack, literally, and some crappy machine. Just training some adult clients then. And then from there, I decided to open up a facility with a business partner. And that was a very messy situation, honestly, where, you know, he was looking at more of training girls to hook up with the girls. And I was looking more.
Jesus, that's a mess.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the worst partnership ever.
If you're a listener, definitely don't try to do that.
Yeah, it was like the stereotypical personal trainer you could ever be, and that was it. You know, I was like, so I didn't want to be that title. You know, I went to school for exercise science, but I wanted to be more on the strength coach side. So
for sure, me too. That was the same way,
So I ended up getting out of that partnership and opened my own facility with no partners, no nothing, with our physical therapist about 7 years ago.
Okay.
And really started attracting baseball players through our knowledge of the lack of, you know, awareness of strength and conditioning for baseball in the community.
Yeah.
So we definitely have had a really good niche on that. And, you know, over 7 years, we went from the 500 square foot spot, and now we have a 12,000 square foot facility in Colorado. You know, work with 200 plus baseball guys from all over the world. So
that's where
we're at now.
Yeah.
A lot of failures.
That's what it takes a little bit of, right?
Yes, absolutely. Best thing in the world.
Bill, how about you? What kind of got your start, foot in the door type of thing? Like, what kind of got you to where you are today?
Yeah, so I started coaching, actual like baseball coaching, at the travel ball level, and those. So the way I would try to swing it with the kids that I coached was, hey, if you want extra strength training on the weekends, maybe 2-3 times a week, there was a small little gym down the street from our house, or from my house, where the travel ball team would train, and they would basically just rent out that space right there and you know, train the guys in the small little weight room that we had there. We had maybe 3 or 4 kids that would consistently come in for lifting, and that's how I got started. I really didn't care so much to do it for money at the time, like as a career. It's just something that, you know, you look at these 15-year-old kids that are playing travel ball, you're like, holy crap, like, this kid's 130 pounds soaking wet, and he wants to play Division I baseball. There's something that's got to be added into this kid's regimen to help him get there. So it just kind of happened naturally. But looking back on it, if there's any young coaches out there who want to get into, like especially in baseball, being a strength coach for that sport, I would get into coaching the sport itself first.
Yeah.
And then offering strength training as something extra and implementing that into their regimen as you go. I really, really think that was a good route for me to take.
I think that's awesome advice. I get a lot of questions all the time about, like, how do you build a business clientele, or just get anybody, you know, any kind of traffic or be known around your area. And I give that advice a lot. Like, I was, you know, a person who linked up with an organization. It was a hockey organization, that allowed me some people to work with right away and, a bit of an audience to kind of, you know, sink my teeth into in terms of just getting experience with coaching and working with some people. So I think that's fantastic advice for sure. So kind of cool to see the both of you have pretty different routes in terms of how you kind of got started.
Yeah,
completely opposite.
Yeah, I mean, but it just goes to show you, like, just like we're going to talk about with training, there's so many ways to get the desired, you know, result. There's the same way in business and in coaching. It just, there's different ways to get to it, and you got to kind of just see what fits best for your situation and all that. So I think that's awesome that you guys have two completely different examples of that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the most common thing we have, you know, is that we both play the sport that we coach in, you know, and that's, I think, like you said, it's the biggest thing, you know, obviously going along with sports specific training or whatever, you know, there's no such thing, obviously, but, you know, it definitely helps to know the demands and the basics of each sport.
Oh, for sure.
Be kind of a guru in the sport you're training for. You know what I mean? You know how the athlete's feeling, you know how the athlete's moving, you know what kind of fatigue they have, why they have that fatigue, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to bring up. And something to kind of expand on that a little bit, like for a listener of a young coach or someone trying to kind of get in the industry, even if you don't have experience, like if you're starting out as a baseball guy and you wind up, you know, like me, like you work with some hockey players, like really take the time to understand the sport of the athletes that you're training, because, you know, like you said, DJ, it's important to know, like, the demands of the energy systems. And, you know, me being a guy with no hockey background whatsoever, in 3 years, I basically just tried to study everything I could about the game, to just learn as much as I could to make the training better for the players. And it goes a long way. So that's a great point.
Yeah, definitely.
So moving a little bit, you know, into the, you know, like I said, the meat and potatoes of the training, I think the topic that I wanted to kind of start with, and I cover this with every guest I have almost, and the reason I think that's okay to do is because velocity-based training is just super important. It's very utilized today, and it has been for years, but it's been talked about more, in my opinion at least. You know, and I know you guys are two guys that utilize it, and I think every coach has, like, their unique outlook, unique philosophies, and how they kind of implement it. So I think it's important to talk to with every single strength coach that I have on or sport coach that I have on here. So I think the first thing I want to talk about in terms of the velocity-based training, you guys can, you know, take this and give me your thoughts on it, but the importance of intensity and how intensity really dictates, you know, the effect you're getting and the training effect you're going to achieve from velocity-based training. Bill, you want to start us off with that?
Yeah, definitely. So probably the coolest thing about velocity-based training is how automatically, once the bar speed sensor is pulled out or whatever method you're using, because you get instant feedback, the intent of the lifter is automatically as high as it can be. And, you know, so you can do a few things, like in terms of measuring and what you do with your measurements. You could measure it from the standpoint of you're trying to hit a certain range for that day, or you could maybe measure to see if you hit a new PR at a certain speed. But regardless, you're getting every single rep to be meaningful. And I can remember so much as a high schooler, you know, not having any real intent when I lifted. It was, all right, we got five sets of five on the board for squat. I'm going to throw on some weight, just do enough effort to get through the reps. And then maybe on my fifth set, you know, that's when I would put forth a lot of effort because the weight is higher. But when the bar sensor is out, all of a sudden, every single rep is maximal effort. That means it's maximal, you know, level of motor unit recruitment that we can create. And then all of a sudden, the force production and those adaptations really start to come about.
Yeah, for sure. DJ, in your opinion, you know, how important is it to have feedback for the athletes and to just have them understand, like, you know, the importance of that bar moving fast when it's a submaximal load?
I mean, that's all we use.
Yeah.
You know, everything we do is DBT through the GymWare software. We begin with force profiling guys, like what Max does. So we'll gauge, you know, we'll get their readiness scores. We'll collect so much data the first day they're in, and then we'll compare that data every single time they come in. So we'll see, like, if they slept like crap, they went out drinking the night before, our pro group or whatever it may be, if they're not, or our program stuff, or their work ethic stuff, or their diet stuff, or whatever it may be. There's so much more that goes beyond just the BBT stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we really like to obviously have our pro group start with the velocity based profiling. We won't do it so much with our high school guys that first start, but first thing we got to do is explain that joint placement dictates muscle function. So we want to explain to them that their joints are malaligned, then they're not going to get optimal output. So they need to complete each rep with proper form. So that's the number one feedback for us.
Yep.
So if we can collect that much data and collect that much stuff, and we're working off the strength speed continuum, where we're going to, you know, build an absolute strength all the way up to absolute speed peak, and we need a peak. It just gives them a better feedback and better number to see, you know, quantitatively as why we see it versus why we're just lifting a weight, just moving weight. You know?
Yeah, for sure. I think both of you brought great points up too. You know, making the athlete understand the importance of, you know, like, you can't just write 55%. Like, if you had a whiteboard, let's say in your facility, and I'm using this as an example because I do. If you wrote the program up for a big group for the day and it said 55% and you didn't explain anything to them about intensity or, you know, how much speed matters to get the desired effect, that 55% becomes like something completely different.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. How do we know they're able to lift 55% that day? You know what I mean? Their readiness might be in a bad situation where they didn't sleep well. Their 55% might actually be, you know, 85% of their max might be 55% that day. You never know. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. No doubt. Yeah, because I think one of the biggest misconceptions about VBT is that it automatically means you're using a light weight and you're moving the bar quickly. That's not quite the case.
Yep.
It's much more about what velocities are we supposed to be working at that day, and that dictates the weight on the bar.
Yeah, it's a great point.
Exactly. Yeah, it depends what phase we're in, right? We could be in a strength phase where we want the guy to move, you know, the bar at 4.45 meters per second. You know what I mean? And that's not happening at all. So it just gives us a gauge versus doing percentage based stuff that says, all right, we're in our strength phase. We want everybody to be hitting at, you know, 0.4 meters per second or 0.40 meters per second. And, you know, here's your prescribed weight off your force profile. And, you know, this one, try and beat it. And if you're beating it, our program's working. If you're not beating it, our program's not. So we, you know, give us good feedback every single time we move.
For sure. I think that's a terrific point that I didn't even think of in terms of the misconception that, you know, VBT is just lighter loads for super fast bar speed, like over a meter per second or things like that. But I remember, you know, for the first time giving some of my, you know, hockey guys that are now in college, because obviously like the program evolved to this point where, you know, we were doing less, you know, true strength work in terms of, you know, triples and doubles that are close to their max, and more like, hey guys, this is 80%. We're moving it as fast as we possibly can, looking for this type of bar speed. And they were just so confused by the concept because they thought it was like impossible to use heavy loads in that way.
Yeah, no doubt.
So that's a fantastic point. In talking standards of velocity-based training, when I say standards, I know, DJ, you kind of alluded to this a little bit, and it's a good segue about, you know, seeing the readiness of the athlete each day when they come in to the facility. And there's so many different ways that you can do that. If you're a listener and you don't have a gigantic budget, there's like a lot of ways you can do this. And honestly, if you really have no budget whatsoever and there's no equipment that you can really afford, like even subjective measures such as just questions and what they did the night before and things like that, to just at least start out as a young coach could be a good way to start, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can use a stopwatch. You know what I mean?
Yeah, just like get an idea of where they are and what they're ready to do.
Yep, see how fast they're moving away from, you know, the concentric to the eccentric or eccentric to the concentric, depending on what you're doing, how fast you can get from end range to end range, and then that's BBT training, old school BBT training.
Yeah, that is old school. That's awesome, though.
Yeah. You can even BBT sled work. You can BBT sled work. You can BBT.
We're gonna get to that for sure.
I mean, we don't do it, but we, you know, you can BBT. I've done it myself, where you BBT chin up, you BBT, you know, whatever it may be, you know. So it's, there's not just sub max weight. There's not just maximal weight. There's everything in between and body weight.
Absolutely,
you know,
yeah. For sure.
You can BBT a TRX Pro. I mean, you can do whatever you want, collect data from it.
But yep.
How you use that data as well, you know?
Absolutely. Bill, I wanted to pose this question to you specifically just because from what I've seen, you know, I know DJ, you even just mentioned it, some of the equipment you have, and I wanted to talk to, you know, Bill a little bit about some advice for listeners who might not have testing devices that are a little more expensive and they want to do some VBT work. I know both of us, and I got this from you, I used it for a little while. It was the Iron Path app on the iPhone. I mean, obviously not super accurate, but if it's something you're using consistently, you can test it against itself. What are some methods you've kind of used?
So I was just about to say the Iron Path app does work very well, and it's really cheap in the App Store. It's not perfect. Like, I had a bar speed sensor that would read probably 0.1 consistently different than the Iron Path, but the Iron Path was at the very least a consistent measuring tool.
Yeah.
So it's not so much about the number itself, but relative to what you've done in the past and what you should be doing that day.
So
actually I don't have a working bar speed sensor. I'm not going to trash talk the company or anything because I have a lot of respect for them, but the sensors that they gave me just flat out broke, and I was waiting for Driveline to drop one this summer, and that's just, I don't think it ever happened. You know, not that I blame them, they got like a million different things they've been doing over there, but either way, so what I've done is I've really been tracking medicine ball throw velocity.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a radar gun, you can just simply throw it for distance and, you know, and try to just measure and see what type of progress you're making with that. And, of course, you can measure broad jump distance, lateral jump distance, and things of that nature as well. It's very inexpensive, but all of a sudden it changes the mindset from simply trying to hit a new one rep max to actually measuring something that is meaningful for your sport.
Yeah, that's a great point. You mentioned, and DJ, you mentioned it before, like you can really apply VBT to so many different things, and it's just not restricted to the barbell. And I was really excited to have both of you on because I know we think similarly in that sense where, like, I've used, you know, different percentages for, like, kneeling sled presses and the landmine and things like that. What are some, you know, other than you mentioned the med balls and you know, throwing them for velocity and all that kind of stuff, what are some ways you guys have applied, you know, VBT to things like sled sprints even or sled pushes or jump training? Whoever wants to jump in, go ahead.
Go ahead. We honestly use BBT for sled presses. We use them for a sled bro. We use them for, mainly, honestly, we keep it simple. Trap bar, RDL. We'll do a reverse lunge with our safety slot bars just to see the different size and see what kind of deficiencies each athlete has on speed-wise. Obviously, if you're a right-handed pitcher, you're going to be a little bit stronger with your left foot forward. Kind of just pulling that stuff out. But, you know, we keep that DVD stuff pretty straightforward. Nothing too crazy, nothing too sexy. We use a lot of laser time. We do a lot of laser stuff, I guess. I mean, that's velocity-based work right there, right? You're sprinting that effort.
Yeah, for sure.
So just collecting that data, part of our assessment process, getting a 10-yard sprint, collecting, you know, where they're at, what they need to work on, get on video. So just, I mean, however you want to move something fast, consider velocity-based. If you want to move something slow, it's still considered velocity-based, right? Just like launch angle of baseball.
Yep.
Every batted ball has a launch angle.
It's a good analogy.
Every weight you move has velocity. So, you know, it's just kind of just really depends on what you want to get out of it, what kind of data you want to push out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, sorry. So I was just going to say with the heavy sled press, or not the heavy sled press, but like a sled press throw, that's something that we've been working with recently where you're just simply throwing the sled for distance, how far it goes, and you could basically...
Are you standing like in a split stance? Like how are you preparing? Like what position are you in for that?
We've been measuring only from a kneeling position.
Okay.
But I guess you could, as long as you keep it the same starting position every time, you'll be able to get some consistent readings. Like you just got to make sure you're using the same sled, the same weight, and the same flooring if you're going to really focus in on a VBT sort of session. If you're simply going for a PR, then, you know, I guess you could throw it however you like, but so long as you try to keep things somewhat the same when measuring, you'll be able to see some pretty reliable results, I think.
The reason I asked was because, and I had never even thought about doing it this way until I saw it. Max posted on his Strong by Science account. He posted, I think it was, he was doing himself. He was doing a split stance pressing variation. And that was the one I originally saw with both of you tagged in. So it had never dawned on me to even try doing it that way. But now I'm like kind of intrigued by it.
Yeah, and dude, it's such a great idea. Like DJ was saying, you don't need to get super fancy with this topic. It's much more about the idea of working for velocity as opposed to simply moving a weight. That's really the goal there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Moving anything with intent, throwing with intent. I mean, everything's intent, right? So if you have a radar gun to throw, you got to have kind of tool to measure the bar, in my opinion. You know, if you're just going out blind, you don't know if you're at a 50% day on the mound or, you know, a blend session or a bullpen session, whatever you may be doing, a 50% bio day or whatever it may be. It needs to be registered and clocked and needs to be collected, and same thing in the weight room, you know. How can we get guys to peak for their season or their spring training or whenever they need to peak? If we're working off peak strength, peak continuum, we're just guessing with how much weight they need to be moving, right? Like we have guys moving 315, 365 between those two things at like 1 meter per second. That has to just fly. You know, so you just say, oh, we're gonna be at speed phase. So we're gonna work at, you know, 185, between 135 and 185. You know, so collecting that, like they're able to actually move heavy weight fast, you know, and that's a big point for us.
Yeah, I think it was Kyle Rogers who brought this up. He DM'd it to me. Someone on Twitter, and I don't like to mention names, so I'm not going to. But they were basically like, you know, quote unquote eye rolling the idea of like, you know, not lifting or thinking that you can, you know, lift too much. I'll give you an example, like, you know, the argument that once you reach a 600-pound trap bar deadlift, you know, is there maybe more, you know, things you could work on in the context of your sport? But basically saying, like, people get the misconception, like we said, of, you know, VBT work being, you know, only lightweights. When you have guys like, you know, Zach DeChamp from TCU that's posting a, you know, 315 front squat from one of his athletes, you know, in that accelerative strength or that strength speed window. It's like way more than that.
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, another misconception along the same line, you think like most kids will look at VBT, most coaches even look at VBT and they say, well, you know, that's only for the advanced lifters. That's only for the advanced, the college guys. It is to the extent that you have to have a mature athlete that when intent is maximal, their form doesn't alter at all.
Yeah,
like you have to have a mature athlete who has trained and has gone through the screenings and everything. But once you realize that they are going to be able to move the bar with high intent and nothing really changes to the technique, put the sensor on, you know, let's see what numbers they can hit and try to get them thinking along those lines. That mindset shift from like a one rep max is the best thing in the world to moving this bar at high speeds is the best thing in the world. That's huge for athletes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree 1,000%.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I've had even, like you said, age, maybe throw that out the window, maybe look at more training age in terms of how long they've been training and if they have control once they, like you said, apply that intent. I've had 13-year-olds utilize, you know, dynamic effort, trap bar lifts and stuff, and they've done really well with it.
Yeah, you can do that just as long as they're mature.
Yep.
As long as they keep their joints stacked and their postural integrity, you know, they're ready to rock and roll.
For sure. In your opinion, what would be the benefits? Like if there's a listener and, you know, I really do think that the importance of, you know, pressing power and ability in its help for throwers is just being more and more uncovered and understood and in the industry today. Like, what would you say are some of the benefits of, you know, increasing that pressing ability, or if we're talking sled work with the, you know, the speed sled presses or anything of that nature? What are some of the benefits for throwing athletes?
I think just scapular control, honestly, right? You know, learning how to get the scap to protract around the thorax when you're pressing.
Yep.
Knowing how to use your actual chest or your pec to press versus to shrug and use the anterior shoulder.
Good point.
You know, getting full range of motion out of stuff. Your pec being an internal rotator of the shoulder, right? So you need to train that. You know what I mean? So it allows you to get layback. It allows for you to take layback and internal rotation. I mean, there's so many different aspects of it that there's so many benefits, right? So to lock the scap down, you want to, you know, you got to be able to retract that scap, have the scap upwardly rotate, have the scap, you know, downwardly rotate even, decentric control and the landmine stress. Whatever you're working on, I think the biggest thing is the scap controlling and scap staying on the door wrap properly. Just like we were talking about how joint placement dictates muscle function, same thing in a pressing motion. If you're altering that position of your rib cage or your thorax, then your scap's going to be altered, then your shoulders can be altered, and your hands can be altered. Same thing in the throwing pattern, right? So just controlling that and learning how to properly execute each movement through a pressing pattern is equally as important as a pulling pattern.
For sure, absolutely.
Those are some really interesting points. Yeah, those are some awesome points, man. One thing for me, I've been really fortunate.
I just made it up. I don't know. I just made it up.
But anyway, no. I've been really fortunate to learn a lot over the past year from Chris Beardsley of SNC Research, and the one thing he's really pointed me in the direction of is looking at the way the muscles are working in both acceleration and sort of the deceleration phases of the movement. And the one thing about the pec is it comes up all the time in hitting and in throwing both. The pec and the anterior delt especially are primary accelerators for the throwing arm. And so it's good to get those stronger. It's good to increase that motor unit recruitment overall. But most importantly, you have to make sure that you're increasing that motor unit firing rate and that ability to produce force at high speeds from that muscle. And those muscle groups, bringing the arm forward, is so important. And that's something we can definitely train with, you know, pressing, of course, heavy, but more powerful means of pressing can train that quality and show that quality even better, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, for sure. I actually, sorry, did I couldn't hear if I cut one of you off. Did I? I apologize.
No, you're good.
All right, there's a delay sometimes. It's hard to get the rhythm down. But I actually, Bill, I think I shared this with you like 6 months, a year ago, had the idea that you could make like the kneeling sled press almost like a plyo push-up, in the sense of, you mentioned like that, you know, decelability of the pec, or the reactivity / elasticity of it, right? Like the upper body works the same as the lower body, like when we're talking sprinting and jumping. I thought of the idea of like having a partner push or pass the sled into the kneeling athlete, where they had to kind of like, you know, accept the load, redirect it as fast as possible, and, you know, press it off their chest, basically kind of, you know, trying to mimic or add in some of that elastic component to the variation.
Yeah, that's a really good one. And on those same lines, if you don't have access to a sled, you could simply just drop a medicine ball with the athlete lying on the ground, and they just do a chest pass right up back to you. And that way works really well. It saves some space too. If you got two guys working together, they could hammer that out in 5 minutes. You know what I mean?
For sure.
Yeah, I think we need to look at, you know, supplying force and absorbing force, right? So we just can't supply it. We got to be able to absorb it. You know what I mean? Your body can only accelerate as much as it allows it to decelerate. So the big thing with us is you want to train deceleration as much, if not more, as, you know, acceleration. So if you're not trained at deceleration component, as, you know, ball coming back into you or a sled coming back into you, you can't control that. You're not going to be able to keep your joint set and explode out of that position.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah, it's just the same as like if you might have an athlete that like you think is ready for a plyometric push-up based on, you know, what they've been doing with their, let's say, resisted push-ups that are heavier. Concentrically, they look fine, but they might just collapse like a house of cards when they drop off that box, right?
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, we always teach, you know, the athletes to, before decelerating, we got to teach them to land. You know, I'm talking about two different things right now, but we can land.
No, but it applies to the upper body too. It's a good exactly. Talking point.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you got to learn to land, decelerate, and then accelerate, right? If you can't learn to stop, then you can't learn to slow, and you can't learn to go. You know, you're never going to achieve any of them. You're never going to achieve any kind of stuff, okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no doubt.
It's almost like people utilize the oscillatory variations. And for a listener who doesn't know what that means, it's almost like, think about going down to a squat, and then halfway you're trying to stop as fast as possible, and then maybe just do the top portion of the squat. There's all three components in there, like that, you know, eccentric, isometric, and concentric, like trying to be able to, you know, redirect forces as fastly and, you know, efficiently as possible. So great points on that.
Yeah, definitely.
So something I wanted to add in, but I didn't have it in the outline originally. I got so caught up in all the, you know, sleds and the VBT and everything. But at the end of the day, we are guys that, you know, work with a lot of baseball players. Talking a little bit of arm care stuff, you know, obviously I think we checked off one of the boxes by talking about the fact that, like, you shouldn't be scared of pressing movements. It gets such a, you know, It's butchered. It's a butchered philosophy in this industry. And it's, you know, I think it's getting weeded out little by little, but, being afraid of pressing is probably like the number one thing that you shouldn't be. But speaking more on arm care in that sense, like, what would you guys say are some of the biggest misconceptions in, a lot of like the high school age athletes, especially?
I think arm care is looking at the shoulder versus the whole body.
Yep.
Right. Arm care is total body care. You know, you got to look at your feet, you got to look at your knees, you got to look at your hips, you got to look at the rib cage, the spine, the scap, everything. You know, force production to the ground, losing that force to the anterior core, or lack of force stability, is a big issue. And, you know, a lot of cuff issues or a lot of elbow issues come from that reason. And a lot of people just address the cuff or the elbow, you know. So looking at the body as a whole, is the biggest misconception I see, the biggest issue I see personally.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. For me, those are great points. I would say that the biggest misconception I've come across is kids think that they can just attach J bands to the wall and rush through some, you know, quick exercises and think that that's enough. to gain any sort of strength in the rear shoulders and any sort of protection, if you will, for those shoulders when throwing. And I just don't think that's the case. If you're going to use those exercises for more of a warm-up routine, you know, go right ahead. But when it comes down to training, I think you have to find a way to increase the load, and you have to find a way to control the scaps through that entire movement, man. If you're rushing through those band exercises, you're not really increasing any sort of scapular awareness, if you will, any sort of coordination wherever the hand goes, the scap goes. And you're probably not increasing strength all that much, because J-bands probably give you about 20 pounds of resistance. So I really think you have to find a way to get more creative, either performing something like a walk-away pull-apart where you increase the resistance as you walk away, or simply just, you know, adding a more resistance band to your routine, I think is definitely something a lot of kids have to take into consideration.
For sure.
And the timing of the band. You know what I mean? Like,
yep.
I don't want our guys to jump on the J-band or do their armchair stuff post-throw. You know, it's like a marathon runner running more to cool down. You know what I mean? Those are our rotator cuff muscles are so small, you know, that we don't want to over-fatigue them. You know, and that's a big issue I see as well, where they're just pounding J-bands and pounding pull parts and all that stuff to throw when they're absolutely fatigued out of their mind after throwing 100 pitches or so in a game.
Yep.
Or throwing a bullpen session or throwing long toss, wherever it may be. You know, there's a time and a place for each thing. And, you know, like Bill was saying, you know, scapular control needs to be the biggest part of arm care, in my opinion. If you can't control your scap, then you're not going to get anywhere. You know, and the scap's not free. If you're doing any movement with your scap's locked down, it's kind of, you know, irrelevant to baseball, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. How about this one? I actually had an athlete last year, year before. I can't remember exactly what it was, but they were doing he was doing a lot of J-band type work, you know, on his own after he was going to his pitching coach. And he actually developed thoracic outlet syndrome. I mean, I don't know if it was the full on, but he developed a lot of, like, I sent him to a PT that I work with, basically, you know, wasn't even using, like you said, you know, making sure you're using those rotator cuff muscles with those bands and not, like, butchering the movement and using completely different muscles. That's going to kind of get you in a worse position.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. I mean,
all elite athletes are going to cheat and find a way to achieve what they want to achieve, right? And that's how injuries happen.
Yeah. Kind of just like when a world-class deadlifter might have to let a little T-spine flexion occur to get a big lift. Like, it's bound to happen sometimes.
Yes, exactly.
I think I didn't even think of, like, bringing that up as a topic. I think that's just so important. I'm glad you guys did about the J-bands. It's like, they're great and they're great tools, but it's not an indictment on the bands themselves because they're great. It's like how people apply them and use them.
Yeah, no doubt. That's like anything.
Go ahead, Bill. What were you going to say?
Oh, no, it's like anything. You know, plyo balls are fine, and, you know, whatever sort of throwing program you do is fine, so long as the intent is right and you're using your body the way it's supposed to be used. But once you start to butcher them, everything, you can take a great program and render it useless.
Yeah, I mean, how many times have you seen guys at the field show up and get into crappy positions, lumbar extension, rib flare, doing J-band? You know what I mean? Guys can't even control it, right? So
I see it with guys in my facility with pull-aparts. I have to correct them all the time. They're just, like, you know, extending the lumbar, and they're just kind of thrusting the band back. I'm like, guys, you got to bear down on these.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, that's when your breathing patterns come into play and bracing the core and getting the ribs down and whatever cues you want to use, but, you know, getting guys to control their body first, you know, and that's why we see such a spike in an injury in baseball, is because the guys don't get into optimal positions. They cheat their way through, you know, and the force production is lost and everything else gets exposed. Same thing on just basic arm care or band routine.
Yeah, if you allow yourself to cheat a band, imagine when you do an actual movement like throwing a baseball or swinging a bat, right?
Yeah. 700 times more forceful on the arm. You know?
Yeah. you're lost at that point.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, so kind of, I'm a big segue guy, and I found a good one, but you mentioned that the misconception that arm care is just, you know, the arm or the shoulder itself when it's a full body thing. And I want to talk a little bit about building rotational power. So that's a great segue because, you know, the body's ability to rotate and resist rotation, of course, are very important in becoming, you know, a better thrower, a faster thrower, increasing your velocity and a more powerful hitter, whatever way you want to look at it. You know, let's talk a little bit about the importance of, you know, anti-rotational stability and general ability to stabilize the spine and the core when it comes to rotational movements.
Yeah, I'm actually watching the kid do power. I'm watching the kid do power presses right now. Actually, he's doing them well. It's his first day in the gym. I'm kind of surprised. Yeah, so I mean, coaches are doing their jobs. That's a good thing. You know, I think just because you play baseball, you think you need to train rotary. That's way far from the truth. You need to be able to, this goes back into what we were just saying, how you need to transfer force and, you know, what your pelvis does and what your ribcage does. And, you know, you're going to rotate in any way, right? So you're going to rotate your knees, you rotate your hips, you rotate your back. You know, you're going to find rotation some way. If you don't know how to rotate properly through your pelvic control or whatever it may be, that's where you're going to, you know, see the, you know, the arch fractures in baseball or the injuries you see in baseball. So, you know, bracing yourself, learning how to brace the core, getting away from rotary exercises and do more of the anti-rotation exercises is the key, just because we need to exhibit that force production, force absorption through the anterior core, and keeping that, you know, postural integrity in mind, keeping, you know, teaching guys to control their body for us, essentially.
Yeah, that's a great point. And on that topic, you know, so I've been measuring medicine ball rotational throw velocities for a long time now. And the one thing I've constantly come across is the guys who can really hone in on good technique with doing a pal-off press, they're the ones that not only do they throw the medicine balls the hardest, but we also see them continually increase the medicine ball throwing as well. So we've measured with a crane scale before, like rotational force production or anti-rotational force production, whichever way you look at it. But that sort of strength that can come about from those exercises is so important, and it can't be understated.
Lack
of pelvic control, right? You see guys doing the anti-rotation exercise in extension. You know, sometimes extension increases velocity, but sometimes it kills guys back. It kills, you know, transfer of force. So we also got to look at each athlete and what their demands are for each athlete. We can't just assume things either. You know what I mean? Because one guy might need rotary stuff in season versus one guy might never need rotational stuff because you over rotate. You know, we have an ultra elite hitter here. He's, you know, top 20 player in the nation. He's, you know, stud, but he's so hypermobile that he can't stop rotating his swing. So that leads to a lot of issues. So then we have kids that can't rotate and can't get load the hip, can't do certain exercises where, you know what, he needs to learn how to do that to achieve proper throwing and hitting mechanics. So we have to, you know, describe those rotary power exercises using the rotary power exercise of the year, whatever it may be.
Yeah, excuse me for the cough, by the way. I'm going through allergy season. Back end's been tough on me. That's a great point. Let me get that one out of the way before I continue to talk. Excuse me. I nail on the head on that. I just, knowing which athlete needs more of, you know, just like the VBT stuff, like don't just assume it's like a one size fits all type thing. As Joe D, we're all DeFranco guys in a little bit. You know, a quote of his that I love is one size fits no one, right?
Yeah, no doubt.
This is like such a small sample size. It's one person, but something I've been wanting to get into more, and I'm going to look to do it with some of the baseball organizations that I work with. But I had an athlete that had a blast motion sensor on their bat, and they were hitting, and I kind of was curious. So I pulled them to the side and had them do like a pal-off iso hold rest 30 seconds and then kind of go into take more swings, almost like a contrast pairing. And their rotational score went up like a tremendous amount. It was actually pretty cool.
That's awesome. Yeah, there's a study that actually did that. So in the study, they did almost exactly what you did. They just measured exit velocity. And after like an isometric hold in a Paloff fashion, all the scores increased by a couple miles per hour. And that's really interesting stuff. Not that I necessarily recommend everyone does that, but in that moment, that athlete may have received some sort of a post-activation effect.
Yes.
Where all of a sudden their core begins working the way it's supposed to, their body begins transferring energy more efficiently, and all of a sudden the swing comes together with a better rotation.
Yeah, absolutely. I even like to think of it a little bit, and I'm not going to talk about this like I have like this all figured out, but I want to say back when I first started, I had like a lot more time on my hands with less clients than I do now. And I was like really into, looking into like the effect of anti-rotation and, you know, that ability on rotation itself, kind of thinking along the lines of, you know, the better anti-rotational ability that, you know, the athlete possesses, to stabilize, it requires actually more energy and force get, you know, put into rotation to initiate it, right? And like, as we know with like Newton's laws, the more force goes into something, the same force comes back out. So I think in that sense, I believe that that is what makes, the anti-rotational, you know, work have a really positive effect on rotation. And if you're seeing it in that like contrast training type of way, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no doubt.
So, kind of moving to wrap things up a little bit, you know, we really didn't talk a lot of speed, so I want to kind of get into that. You know, I mentioned that I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, obviously how we get guys faster and some advice for the listeners if you're, you know, an athlete looking to go to a showcase or just get their 60 time down, and then kind of finish up with, after telling you how to get better at the 60, kind of tell you why it's not a great test and what are some better alternatives that the, you know, baseball community can, you know, move into. Starting things off, and Bill, you could take this one first if you want, talking a little bit about the importance of acceleration, especially in baseball, and how much acceleration comes into play in the sport.
Yeah, I mean, spoiler alert, the 60-yard dash sucks because you're spending a whole lot of time at top speed, and it's not really dictated by how well you can accelerate. But as far as training for acceleration, it can get a little bit tricky. You really have to, like DJ mentioned this before about force velocity profiling, how effective of a tool that can be. If you don't have a very strong athlete, they're probably not going to accelerate as quickly as you would like if they're not very forceful out of that start, especially relatively to their body weight. But through looking at some research, what I've found is actually assisted sprinting, using bands for assistance when sprinting, actually works really, really well for this acceleration phase. But regardless of the method of training that you use for accelerating faster, you have to get up to top speed as quickly as possible. And if you can't do that, you're probably not going to be a very good runner out in the baseball field. Everything we do is, you know, within 30 yards in a straight line. And if you can't get down the line quickly, you can't steal bases, and you're probably not going to run balls down out in the outfield as well. So,
yeah.
Very important to accelerate well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can't have speed without strength, right? Strength is the foundation of all movement.
So absolutely. Yep.
We preach our guys, you know, to our guys, you know, you need to be strong first so that you can express force. And then, you know, I don't want that you're naturally going to get stronger. But that's going to naturally help you increase and force production, going back to that, and that's going to naturally work its way up through the kinetic chain, and you're going to accelerate better, decelerate better. And, you know, like, we really like to work on, you know, reverse lunges, rear-foot elevated foot squats, a lot of single leg foot stance positions, just because that gets you in a sprint position. So, you know, we have a really good speed coach here. He, you know, takes every single guy in our program on Tuesdays and Thursdays through mechanical work, right? But he won't allow those guys to do any kind of speed work until they can actually prove that they're moving weight fast, efficiently, and with, you know, with strength. So
you know, back in the day, it was like, all right, you know, we have a 9-year-old, a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, 12-year-old, whatever it may be, coming to the facility. Let's work on plyometrics right off the bat versus teaching them how to move properly through loads, right? So,
yeah, I agree
about it. A 10-year-old carries load all the time. He has his backpack on, he's swinging a bat, he's throwing a ball, whatever it may be. His body's demanding a lot on the load aspect. So, you know, why can't we just teach him a basic goblet squat with under some light load, you know? So versus, you know, him having his knee go completely valgus, tearing his knee, let's work on, you know, how his joints are going to be aligned. Let's work on how he's going to get stronger to produce more force. And then, you know, work on the acceleration component after we hit all those check marks.
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, on a little bit on a different note, but another method that we can use to help train this sort of force production right off the bat is using I've been doing this for a while. I've been using a sled and then a release from the sled. So about 5 or 6 steps of the sled and then release and then sprint from there. But from what I've noticed, I think the most effective means of increasing the effectiveness of your sprinting for that start is simply by making sure that the guys are going like off of a go call, some sort of a clap or an audible sound or something to give them a cue to go. It increases the firing rate and that neural signaling so much better than just simply having the kid go on their own without any sort of external cue.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, train reaction is a huge component of baseball, you know, and that falls under the category of acceleration. You know, if you can't react, accelerate on demand, then you're never going to get a good reading on the ball off the bat, you know? So
yeah, 100%. Yeah.
That's, you know, controlling your body and creating that potential energy and, you know, using that potential energy and all that kind of stuff is going to play a big part in your speed, you know?
For sure. Just if you're a young athlete listening to this, and I get a lot of questions like this, so I know that you're out there, and you want to get faster, like Bill and DJ said, like, you have to be able to produce force before you ever think about improving the rate in which you do that, if that makes sense. So like, be able to put more into the ground, get your, you know, like you said, get your joints in the right positions with your lifts and make sure that you're able to actually, you know, have strength relative to your body size. And that's going to be the first piece to, you know, improving your speed overall before you worry about anything else.
Yeah, no doubt.
Body control, number one for sure. Absolutely.
It infuriates me when I see, you know, young kids going to speed classes, quote unquote speed classes, and they're 12, 13 years old, can't even, you know, do a proper like goblet squat in terms of just, you know, being strong at all in the lower half. And they're worried about, you know, hopping over hurdles and getting their feet quicker. It just, it's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, it's just for show.
No doubt about it.
Right. It's just for show. You know, it's just collecting parents' money, essentially, in my opinion.
Dude, for real. No doubt.
And people, like, it's a shame that a lot of parents are misinformed to think that if you don't have that kind of stuff involved in, like, the first 6 months of a, you know, 12-year-old's training, that you're not working on speed. It just couldn't be further from the truth. Like, the movement pattern work, the proficiency you're building in those patterns, and the strength you're building, it just goes all towards speed. It's like it builds up to it.
Yeah, man, I've had that same conversation, like, at least 10 times this year. And the thing I always try to get across to him is, like, I want your kid to be a college level player in 6 years, in 7 years. It's a long process. And think of all the cool things that we'll be doing in 2 or 3 or 4 years that don't even resemble what we're doing right now necessarily. But it takes a long process to get there in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. Process is the best part, right? People need to understand that. It's all about the result, about the now versus the future.
Yeah, I mean, I would just chalk it up to as simple as if you're doing, you know, hurdle hops and quick feet stuff, and, you know, you're doing that for 6 months to a year, and your teammate's doing, you know, work to get their patterns right and build strength, and then mixing sprints in with that and acceleration work, like, they're going to blow you out of the water in a certain amount of time. It's just how it works.
I get elite high school kids, even, or their parents, you know, emailing me, calling me, weekly, like, hey, when are we going to start the speed program. Like, well, you need to get stronger first. That is your speed program.
Yeah, you are doing a speed program.
yeah, exactly. So just need to, the biometric phase back in the 90s or whatever kind of screwing us now, essentially. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's no doubt. It's not even like you can still, like, I'm a guy that believes that, you know, with a young athlete especially, if you have a strength focus, you know, kind of right away and getting them right in that sense, you know, it's okay to, like, a good, like, teaching them how to land on a box jump, load properly. You get so much more out of that when you have it accompanied by that strength work and that force production, building that up. Like, it works so much better.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
You're not going to be able to hold those positions needed to land off the box or jump onto a box or whatever if you're not strong enough to hold the machine angle or the femur angle or whatever it may be. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's crazy. People think you have to be, you know, tap dancing around to be getting faster. It's just ridiculous.
it looks cool, though.
Yeah, no, it gets a lot of likes, right?
Yeah, and then you get those people that say, all right, well, you know, I deadlift 600 pounds. Why don't I run a, you know, 6'5", 6'6", you know?
Oh, it's both sides annoy me equally, if you want to know the truth.
Yeah, exactly. So you have the pure extreme on the train side, and you got the pure extreme on the agility side. You know, you got to meet, not essentially in the middle, but somewhere in the middle.
It's a gray area that you have to decide where you land based on the situation. And unfortunately, it's not sexy enough to talk about that on social media. Like, no, you know,
absolutely.
It just becomes easier to be black and white and very extreme on one side, I guess, easier to portray your message in that sense. And I caught a lot of flack. I put that video out last week or 2 weeks ago. Not a lot of flack. I caught some from, like, the extremists of the strength side of things. What I said, you know, Max put it really well on last week's episode. You know, is there strong enough in a squat in the context of sport if you're not constraining the movement with, like, you know, a speed or things like that? Of course. No one's ever saying it's bad to be strong in the context of your sport, but it's like, you know, is lifting 50 more pounds on a barbell to 700 pounds going to do much for you if it's not in the context of your sport?
Yeah, no doubt. Exactly. And, you know, one thing I will say, I mean, there's a lot of confusion out there. And, like, I'm sure there's going to be plenty of coaches and players listening to this. So, like, you know, well, I saw these agility drills and I saw these drills, you know, there. I thought they were working. If you really want to test and see if something's working, man, bust out the stopwatch and measure your sprints. And if you're increasing over a 3 or 4 week period as a result of your training, then, hey, you know, God bless you, it's working. But I would be willing to bet, man, if you're a very scrawny, weak kid and you get yourself on a legitimate strength and conditioning program that increases your coordination, your ability to remain stable and balanced, as well as increased force production, you're going to see that stopwatch show you better and better numbers. I guarantee it, man.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. I mean, that's just like the VBT stuff, right? If there's a tool there to use to measure something, guys have better output, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%, man.
Yeah. You can't let yourself get caught up in the subjective parts of things like, oh, he looks faster, his feet look quicker. Like, you need to know, like, Mac, again, I keep alluding back to the guy because he's a friggin' genius. Mac said it last week on the episode, but, like, using the, you know, metrics or testing measures to let you see the effectiveness of your programming and what you're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no other way.
His head's not going to be able to fit through the door if he listens to this.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody comes to you and says the program's not working, like, well, look where you started. At deadlifting 135 pounds, now you're deadlifting 275 pounds. How do you say it's not working? You know,
exactly. So, yeah. And in the same token, it's been like, you know, you went from 135 to 275, and you went from a 7.6 to a 7.2. Like, how could you say that's not a good way to get you faster?
Exactly. And they just want to see that 6.5 pop up, right? That's all they care about.
Yeah.
Like, it's magic.
Yeah. Exactly.
So real quick, just to kind of wrap things up, because I don't care if this is beat to death. I think the 60 needs to be, you know, shit on nonstop because anything they need to get rid of it. We can throw some curse words in there to finish up. I have the explicit button I could press on this thing. But it infuriates me that there are still people that will literally argue with. I can give you the best points, the best examples, the reasons why it's ineffective, and people will still argue with me on, like, oh, it's been done for years. It's a really quick way to do it. Like, it's so ineffective in terms of quote unquote baseball speed. Like, it just blows my mind.
Yeah, I feel like everybody on Twitter blew that up last week, or is that just me? I tweeted about it last week. I know that. I mean, every thread I saw last week is about how much the 60 sucks. I loved it.
Oh, it was. Did you see that? I would love to shout him out while we talk. I'm gonna go look for who it was and what the post was, because I would love to shout them out. They had a really good. It was a college coach using a first to third test.
That was on my thread, I believe.
I'm going to look for it because I retweeted it.
First home to first, and then first to third, and second to homes, or something like that.
Yeah, it was.
But yeah,
it was something along those lines. It's just nice to see more people are moving away from thinking it's a good test for sure.
Yeah, I mean, baseball, in my opinion, you need to work on change of direction, right? Like a 5-10-5 would be great. You know, a 10-yard start, because baseball is an acceleration sport. A flying 10, because you're hitting as close to top end speed for 10 yards. That's about it. And then maybe like a way to justify a 30-yard sprint.
It was Jim Chester, Gardner Webb head coach.
Okay, nice.
It was a video of a first to third. Just basically they have like cones laid out like into a secondary lead, and they measure it that way. I thought that was awesome.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's just like, you know, these showcases, the big time showcases now, it's like, why would we change? We're making so much money.
Yeah.
Right. And this is the way it's always been done. So why make things harder on ourselves? You know, there's forming into the new age stuff. It's like, all right, well, you know, people are paying us $2,000 to go to our showcase. That's complete bullshit. In the first place, you know, where we could, you know, just broadcast somebody on YouTube or, you know, Flatground app or whatever it may be nowadays, and get them signed. You know, they're just, you know, pumping out, all right, let's just do a 60, let's do an exit below for the chief, and an outfield throw, and you're giving us $2,000. Thank you.
Isn't that a shame?
Ridiculous.
That's like an excuse, is that it's easier?
Yeah, that's their excuse, man. I know that for a fact. You know that.
Oh, that's been said to me before. That's a reason enough to keep doing it, is that it's easier. I had a guy tell me it's like a really long test, so it makes it easier to time and it makes it easier to weed guys out. I'm like, that is insane to me to hear that.
Yeah, and it just shows right there they truly don't care about player development. You know, and people are going to shun me for saying that, but that's the truth. You know,
why beat around the bush? It's a fact.
Yeah, it really is, man.
Yeah, but they're making bank, so...
Yeah, just looking at it from the perspective, this really changed my whole outlook on it like a year and a half ago. I would love to find it where I saw this, but 7 of the 11 strides the average MLB player takes from first to second on a steal are in acceleration. 65%.
But why do anything else?
Yeah, where the 60, if you're generous and said that acceleration was 15 yards out of the 60, you're looking at like 75% of that test is a top speed test in a sport where like 70% of it's acceleration.
We got to look at catch probability too, right? So like in your lower catch probabilities, how often are those guys reaching top end speed even?
Yeah.
Right? Yep, even like a 5%, 10% catch probability in the outfield, guys are still in acceleration phase. You know, they're never
reaching top end.
So, you know, you might go top end speed from, first to home, maybe, you know, first to 30, maybe first to third. But, you know, the guys are so quick now that they're still in the acceleration phase and they're turning, you know, so they're turning left, right? So, I mean, you're never reaching that straight top end position that all these people, you know, want to have you do.
It's a shame. I mean, hopefully more guys like us talking about it and, you know, more tweets and things like that are going to help move the needle a little bit. And You know, I think unfortunately until the big showcase model with these companies that have like a monopoly on it are done away with, it's going to keep on happening. But I think the more coaches that show they don't really value it, the better it's going to be. I mean, obviously if someone runs a 6.4, like they're going to be fast no matter what.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's like maybe that 7.1 runner actually is a really good accelerator and they're fast for what you need them for and that their top speed is just not good.
Yep. Yeah, and the best way to alter your 60 time is to have a shitty or a really good start. You know what I mean? So,
yep.
There you go. You know, that shows everything right there. You can make a kid go from a 179 or 189 or whatever to down to 1.5 or 1.45 or whatever on a 10-yard split, and they change their whole 60 time just because of their acceleration.
Now they're running a 6.6 instead of a 7.
Exactly. And, you know, nobody looks at important for that first 10 yards or even the first 30 yards, you know, when you're acceleration.
Joe D said that with his work with NFL guys, right? He was getting all the 10-yard sprints down because that's all he had in terms of space, and the 40s, like he was working with a lot of NFL guys or football guys, so it was the 40 instead of a 60, but the 40 times were just dropping tremendously when they were improving the
10s. Yeah, that's how it goes, man. Yeah, I really think the showcase world in general just flat out sucks. Like the audacity that you pay this kind of money for one day and you might show well, you might not. Like you might be sick with the flu that day, you might not, you know, like you might be training solely for drills like the 5-10-5 for months and you might be really good at just that drill. Like I think there's so many ways that the numbers can get skewed. You know, I honestly feel like certainly like the shorter sprints are a good step in the right direction, but I think a better means of seeing how great, like just say an outfielder is, for instance, set up a two-way tire machine or two tire machines out in the field and have them shoot a ball into the gap. And the athlete stands out in center field. He doesn't know which way the ball is going to go. You shoot a ball up into the gap, everybody's got to get to that ball, and they're reacting to it, and they have to cover ground and make a catch. To me, I think that's the way showcases should start to go. They should start to be things that we can compare to each other, but also things that are something we can't really practice for, if you catch my drift, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you can't match the point that you can't play baseball, right? It's like, you have to catch the ball at full speed and acceleration, and if you can't catch the ball, why are you here? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
exactly.
That creates so many good points there for sure. It's just the sad thing is it's not going to change, right? It's just, I mean, as much as we push the needle, it's just, you know, people are making too much money and kids are paying too much money for these summer teams and volleyball teams and travel ball teams, and that's the way it is. You know, it's a money-making industry. Like, granted, we're in it too, right? You know, so, but we're on the side where people hate us, so which is where we want to be, in my opinion. You know?
Yeah, we gotta shut that guy up, or else they're gonna get rid of our 60s.
Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. So, I mean, as long as we have the right people on our network and the right, you know, like Bacon at ECU is one of my good buddies. Like him and I, like we get it. Like he'll tell his coaching staff that we have dudes. And that's the way showcases really work. Like, it's who you know, it's who you develop, and how you develop them, and what kind of people they are.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. Absolutely. Guys, I always apologize for putting my guests on the spot, but I keep doing it. I love to just ask. I love to just ask if there was any kind of like a way you wanted to wrap up. You know, it's your episode, right? Like, you're my guest, and you know, what you guys have to say is important. Either of you have any like parting thoughts for the listener on anything we talked about or anything else we didn't talk about?
I think we covered a lot.
We did. We did a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think the discussion on the 60 and why it sucks was a fun way to end it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess if I had a closing thought, it would just be basically a wrap up of what we talked about at the beginning segment of the show. Is if you have a means of measuring velocity or some sort of power output, measure it all the time and measure your training against that tool
whether it be a broad jump for distance or a med ball throw for distance or for the radar gun, whatever the case may be, if you're working against that, even if you don't have a lot of fancy equipment, I think you're going to start to find the effectiveness of your training increases exponentially.
Yeah, just have a reason why. You know what I mean? Why are you doing what you're doing? And just, you know, taking the accountability for what you're doing and have the consistency for what you want to do. That's what we preach, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Guys, I want to thank you so much for coming on. That was an awesome episode. Super excited to get that out. Just alone in the fact that we talked about so many different things and got, you know, a lot covered on those areas. So thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
That was fun.
Yeah,
was fun.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you guys both. I really think that it's awesome to be a part of this sort of conversation of extremely intelligent people who are bringing a lot to the sport and strength and conditioning. It's awesome to be a part of your guys' conversation.
Yeah, same to you guys as well. Okay. That, well said.
Yeah, thank you. I definitely don't deserve to be on this, but I appreciate it.
Oh, get out of here.
You're the man, DJ.
Guys, appreciate you guys. Appreciate you.
Hey, thank you so much for coming on. Look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks again.
All right. Talk to you guys soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Muscles and Management, brought to you by Challenger Strength. Tune in next week for the newest installment of the show that is changing how we view training, sports performance, and business.